We are.
Okay. Switching to Countrywide.
Yep.
We've seen, I don't have them in front of me, but I believe the OCC's ratings throughout were pretty good on Countrywide. You know, they were all ones and twos, I think, leading up to the charter flip, to the thrift charter in the application December of 06, approved March of 07. Do you guys have any concerns about Countrywide? I mean, given those ratings, it appears no, in the overall sense. But
yeah, my understanding. You know, I occasionally got briefed on Countrywide. They, you know, attention to them because they were in the portfolio of banks. I don't recall them ever being rated less than two on a composite.
Right. How about if we go to the report, the ROE?
Okay. Well, I can tell you at the time. They were straight twos with the
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you.
The exception of asset quality, which is a wonderful
report.
What report do you want to go to?
The last one.
Okay.
Which is, unless you don't have it with you.
It doesn't matter that I don't have it with me. We can still go to it.
The 2005 ROE, which probably we should refer to as document number 7.
Okay.
And that's your...
Yes, year end December.
Yeah.
It's more, the actual ROE is dated March 31, 2006,
yep.
But Kim said it's as of December
right.
31st,
right.
2005.
Yeah. Okay, okay.
Okay. Yeah, if you turn to page 4, yeah. You'll see the ratings.
Right.
Yep. And I guess, you know, to be fair, when I ask you, did you have any concerns, I should tell you that if, based on our whopping, incredible, detailed financial analysis so far, the one thing that stands out to me anyway is that, you know, again, surprise, surprise, large growth, leverage growth,
right.
You know, both on balance sheet and even more so off balance sheet. The servicing book was up to like 1.4 trillion, I think, at the end of 07, probably close to that at the end
right.
of 06 when they switched charters. And of course, you know, a lot of that growth in the quote unquote non-traditional mortgage product, whether it's subprime, whether it's all day, whether it's a payment option arm, interest only, et cetera. And we know, you know, now, with the benefit of hindsight, that, you know, concerns about the values of those assets and the freezing of the credit markets in the fall of 07 is what led to Countrywide's liquidity crisis, the $2 billion investment by B of A and then the subsequent acquisition by B of A. And you may or may not know there's been some releases of emails and other documents by congressional committees and lawsuits that indicate, you know, back in 04 and 05 and 06, the folks, the management within Countrywide certainly recognized that the default rates on the stuff they were originating, whether it was for sale or for the on-book portfolio, were going to be quite a bit higher than your normal stuff. Yet they were reporting positive earnings and capital compliance and all that, and we see the ratings we see. So that's why, really in an attempt to save time,
yep.
You know, were there concerns by the OCC
well,
despite the ratings we see?
Couple key things as it relates to Countrywide. One, you know, we had the bank. The substantive servicing origination activity occurred outside the bank. So, so our ratings obviously reflect risk activities inherent in Countrywide Bank N.A.
Right.
Much of Countrywide's origination stuff, not all, but much, was done in Countrywide Home Loans, which is a non-bank sub. The Federal Reserve would have had oversight of that. And the servicing, I believe, was all done outside the bank. It's a little different than other, you know, broader commercial banks in the sense that, there were the home equity and, you know, the interest-only pay option stuff, even though they originated, much of the origination was done through Countrywide Home Loans. It was funded and booked in the bank. So there are aspects of what I call the chain, the product delivery chain there that, you know, wouldn't have been things we had under our jurisdiction. But with that said, certainly aware of the growth. I mean, one of the reasons why we took the former Treasury Bank as it started out and in an 04 moved it to large banks was because of the strategy that Countrywide had announced to us of really using that national bank charter to hold and fund the growth in the residential products that they were talking about. And we thought it made better sense to put it under constant attention of an examiner in charge with some specialists, get it into our program where we have other large mortgage, retail mortgage players, and subject it to kind of a more common oversight, to be honest with you. Now, with that said, I knew there was growth. I knew they had non-traditional mortgage products. We paid close attention to that. At the time we had it, we weren't seeing, from what I recall, a lot of deterioration that eventually played out in the market for retail mortgages. I mean, I guess you could say from our standpoint, fortunately converted away from the national charter before everything hit the fan. But certainly the growth and the nature of the product that eventually hit the fan resided in the bank for a while. And we were aware of that and concerned that they have the right risk management. It kind of predated the actual issuance of the non-traditional mortgage guidance, but we certainly were paying very close attention to pay option and interest-only stuff, the home equity. We actually were successful in keeping subprime predominantly out of the bank. There's some, but they approached us sometime in the 2004-05 arena with a plan to really target subprime, funding it through the bank, and we told them no. And that largely stayed away from the bank while it was a national bank. But they did do pay option, they did do interest-only, ARM kind of things that, clearly were non-traditional things, low doc, low FICO, stated income, all that stuff which hit the fan, those things were there. But they always supported the capital, they made reasonable money, they made sure the liquidity, et cetera, was there. So the overall sense of the condition of the bank was that it never fell below a satisfactory condition.
What do you, I'm sort of going into a little about what Al was talking about in terms of concentrations, and second, in terms of the company's reporting earnings and you're not seeing delinquencies on loans, but, of course, by their nature, these kind of loans don't go delinquent.
Very liberal repayment. In fact, some of them, it's negative AM kind of stuff.
Defer the payment of principal and, in some cases, interest.
Right.
So, and what I'm getting at is what did the OCC have concerns, one or two? What are the examination procedures for really evaluating the riskiness of a loan portfolio that's fairly concentrated as a percentage of capital, if not a percentage of assets, when traditional performance measures like delinquencies are not a good measure because they don't really capture what may be the inherent risk in those loan products?
We did our best to try to, we drew attention to negative amortization. In fact, we instructed our examiners, we told them back in 05, actually sent a message out to them that we don't want to see banks doing negative AM. These guys did it. We never said, we never issued a rule prohibiting it. But besides them, we only had really one other player that decided to continue to pursue pay option to any degree, which is where the negative AM really resided. We took the guidance that at the time we were contemplating, looked at risk factors, whether it was FICO, loan-to-value, you know, as much as we could to make sure that, you know, they were towing the line and at least in the bank dealing more on a prime basis with folks than dealing with the lower end of the risk scale. You know, but we didn't say no, stop. And we tried to just make sure that the risk was being understood. There was adequate capital liquidity. We understood it was a concentrated business. You know, it wasn't a broad, diversified bank. It wasn't a bank that had a lot of, didn't have traditional branches. It was funded differently. And increasingly, you know, we were critical around the risk management, which I think triggered, had a lot to do with the eventual decision of them to convert.
Which brings me to the next topic I wanted to ask you about. What is your understanding of why they switched charters?
Very little conversation about it. In April of 06, the controller and I visited Countrywide Management. Angelo Mazzillo, I think Stan Kerlin was there, and the two key officers of the bank, Jim Furash and Carlos, I can't remember Carlos.
Garcia.
And I go out periodically, and the controller typically joins me to meet with management, but we were visiting there. And the first question out of Angelo's mouth when we sat down at the table was, why, tell me why we shouldn't be a thrift. So that was my first introduction to him as the controllers, and that's his first question. My antenna is up that, okay, he's thinking, why should I be, you know, a national bank? And, you know, in that conversation, you know, he never threatened or stated they were going to convert. He just asked the basic question. But he also, in that meeting, expressed concern over at least one of the examination aspects that we were pushing him on, and that was the independence of appraisal order. And he was concerned that you know, they were being singled out. The approach we were taking would have competitive consequences to them in the market. Was kind of appealing that we should take a second look at that. The Fed was, I knew the Fed was also on the same page with that, may have acted a little later, but still the same issue was coming that way.
I'm sorry, I'm not following. The Fed was on the same page with what?
Same concern. Because
the appraisal ordering issue?
Most of Countrywide was outside the bank. So
right.
The Fed, it was very important for the Fed to be expressing a similar concern on appraisals, because the appraisal process wasn't unique to the bank. It was something done for the corporation.
And you're sure that the Fed shared that same concern, as opposed to feeling the opposite way and saying we don't need independent appraisal order?
No, they were holding the line. You know, I think there was a reason, in my understanding, it was pretty good collaboration and understanding. Actually, I think the head of the the CPC, as they call it, at the Fed, was a former OCC. Large bank person. So
is that a credit policy committee, CPC?
No, it's a central point of contact.
All right, not even close.
But anyway, so we knew, he knew us, we knew him, we also knew what he was saying. And so I had the meeting in April, which was, you know, just a typical visit. Wasn't, you know, orchestrated in any other, you know, purpose. And then in November, the comptroller receives a call from Angelo in early November, saying we are informing him that he had made the decision to convert to a thrift charter.
And do you understand? I mean, I hear what you just said, but do you have an understanding of why they decided to switch to a thrift charter?
My understanding, I never talked to him directly. My understanding was he was looking at the efficiency of taking dual regulators down to one regulator, and that his primary business of mortgage lending was one that one regulator was obviously the Thrift Charter was most familiar with and organized for. So I don't recall any discussion of, you know, you guys are just, you know, pounding this into the pavement, so, you know, we want to run from that or anything else. It was just basically a straightforward, and I recall his public comments, he being Mozilla's, were similar to that. You know, we have dual regulators referring to the Fed and us, and we can have a more efficient regulatory process by going to one.
Okay. Did you ever, understanding what you heard Mr. Mozilla said were the reasons why to the OCC and publicly that you read in the press or wherever you saw it, you mentioned this issue about the independent appraisal ordering. I mean, did you ever hear that that was a factor in them switching over? And one, and two, did the OTS, if you know, require independent appraisal ordering?
I can't answer that. They should, because it's part of an interagency regulatory process.
Was it then?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. It's all under
USPAP, right? Is it a USPAP?
Yeah, USPAP, Part 34. Is it Part 34 for us?
I don't know.
I think it is Part 34 with the appraisal regs and all that. But, yeah, that was a broader agency effort. And independent, having the appraisal ordering process independent of the loan origination channels or the lending function. And they had it where lenders were involved in the appraisal ordering, which is kind of a major no-no. They weren't the only ones that had drifted that way. I don't recall any direct conversation with the OTS before the conversion. And I can recall, I think, a phone call sometime before they actually converted to a thrift charter, which was March of 07, maybe talking to Scott Polikoff at the OTS. But it wasn't a conversation that where I was expressing concern to him, or we were getting into the nitty-gritty of our supervision versus what they intended to do. It was more on, you know, let's have a smooth transition kind of thing is what I recall. I don't have any notes or anything on it, but I think it was one phone call.
Okay.
Now, you know, I don't think, you know, Kim had interaction, I think, with the local office out there.
Right. Okay, so understanding you didn't have discussions with the OTS about it, and maybe you answered this and I just didn't hear it because I'm getting tired too.
When you say about it, are you talking about
the independent appraisal order? Okay. And whether or not the OTS required it also. But did you ever hear that the issue of having independent appraisal ordering contributed to countrywide switching charters?
I don't recall that directly. I surmise that it was one of probably several factors may have contributed. I mean, there was clearly a growing sense of the bank management, of our demands, you know, all the interagent, the non-traditional guidance. I mean, there was a lot of fanfare. I think the Fed was holding steady with, I know the appraisal thing, they may have had other issues or similar issues to what we had, I don't know that in comparison, but my sense was they were feeling, that we were, pressing them, and, and they didn't like it. That was the body language I got from Angelo. Mm-hmm. So many words. He never was direct that way, but that was certainly the impression I had.
I believe it was at least reported in the press around that time that another reason that countrywide, may have been switching charter was simply shopping for a weaker regulator. Did you ever hear anything like that other than perhaps reading it in the press?
I heard it in the press. I never had a direct conversation that way. I know we were surprised. My sense was that the bank management was surprised with the decision. And I think, quite frankly, I did talk to Jim Furash after the decision was made. And
who was the general counsel?
He was the president, of Countrywide Bank N.A. No longer is. He left shortly after, I think, the conversion. But my sense was he was disappointed in the decision and probably didn't agree with the decision, but it clearly wasn't his decision. So.
And what was the basis for that sense?
A phone call and just what he said.
I mean, did he say that?
Yeah, he was disappointed that they weren't going to continue because he felt our supervision was good. It was fair. It was objective, constructive. And I know Carlos Garcia felt the same way. I mean, I was always we had a respectable relationship with them. We rarely dealt with Angelo or Stan Kirby, who I think was the number two guy at the corporate level. And so. Yeah, I just was reading the tea leaves a little bit there. I mean, they were not just espousing, and dumping on Angelo. But I've been around enough to know what he was trying to tell me.
And when you say you knew Garcia felt the same way, what's the basis for that?
Just our interaction with him, what I heard from the exam team. My general, I've met with him several times on visits, and he seemed like a pretty straightforward, straight-shooting individual. Mm-hmm. And if he was disappointed, I would characterize a disappointment as just, he didn't understand why it made sense to do that. So,
other than, them indicating that they were disappointed and disagreed with the decision, didn't understand what was being made, and that you guys were giving him a fair shake. Anything else said about why they were disappointed and disagreed? Were they concerned about having to deal with the OTS?
No, I never heard anything directly to the OTS. I would characterize the sentiment from Furash and Garcia as being disappointment that we weren't going to be supervising because they felt it was a reasonable regulatory banker relationship, but they never singled out anything. I never was in a conversation with the bank or anyone else that would have singled out DOTS. I am aware of the public comments that were made, but I never heard that directly. Mm-hmm. And I never had a conversation with the OTS challenging them, around that aspect at all.
Okay. So, So the OT, our understanding is that the OTS, in doing their due diligence on whether or not they were going to improve the charter application, to a large extent, looked at appropriately OCC reports, federal exam. Federal Reserve exam reports, and talk to OCC and Federal Reserve people. Did you talk to the OTS as part of their due diligence process? Do you know, other than this, I guess, one phone call with Polakoff on let's have a smooth transition?
No.
Okay. Understanding you didn't talk to them with the OTS, did you know what they were doing due diligence wise from talking to your people?
Not specifically. It was never described to me. I don't recall from Kim. REIC heard saying much other than that she was in contact with OTS people regarding their conversion application. My instruction to her was, continue doing, what you think's reasonable here till it is converted. Cooperate with them, which is kind of our standard instruction. But I'm not even aware of whether they being OTS went on site. Did any due diligence, whether it was just simply an office desk-based review of this kind of, the reports and telephone conversations with Kim. I'm not aware of anything else that they would have done. They may have, but I'm just not aware of it.
We learned that the OTS was in this timeframe and somewhat before, at least when Rich became the director of the OTS, for lack of a better term, increased their efforts in letting be known the benefits of the thrift charter vis-a-vis the national bank charter. And amongst other things, would attend conventions and trade shows, and I just have the little pamphlet, you know, the director's guide and things like that to hand out to say where the OTS here's what's great. Now, we've also heard that the FDIC and the OCC were doing the same thing. Did the OCC, you know, attend the trade shows or otherwise, you know, have a program or an outreach program or whatever to say here's the benefits of a national bank charter?
Yeah, we've had, I haven't been directly involved in it, but we actually have people, you know, who go to these trade conferences, you know, state banking conventions, you know, wherever they are. Not unusual to have all the regulators there, although I think in some cases not all attend. But, you know, our approach is to explain what, the supervision, the national charter, it's not propaganda. I mean, we're not out recruiting people actively away from other regulators. Our basis of our outreach is to make sure people understand who we are, what we do. We do label the benefits of a national charter. But it's up to the management and boards of those organizations to make decisions. You know, we don't cold call and go around trying to convince people. If we're approached, we'll certainly talk to individuals about that, but we certainly don't go out and just outwardly solicit at the conventions or one-on-one. If someone comes to us and has interest, certainly we talk to them and tell them the benefits of a national charter and what it's like to be supervised, what our expectations are, and that kind of thing. So I had heard the OTS was maybe going a little bit further down that path in a persuasive way, but I never directly was engaged in a situation that I'm aware of. It may have happened at Countrywide, but I was never directly aware of them outwardly doing that. If they did it, it wasn't something I knew of.
And you say you heard the OTS was going further down that path. Who did you hear that
secondhand
from?
Sources. Yeah, I'd never observed it directly. I'd heard people say they're trying to convince people that on the benefits of thrifts, but it's not anything I didn't attend those conventions or witness that kind of stuff. It's all secondhand information.
Do you know who those secondhand people were? I mean,
who were out in the midst of doing it. I don't know if I ever heard it from bankers per se, but I may have heard it from our people who were out at those conferences.
Okay, just don't recall who.
Okay. No, typically that aspect is handled more on our small community bank side than it is the large banks. I don't run I don't have an outreach program for large banks.
Sure. So let me ask you to comment on that more generally, because it is an area that we are trying to understand better, because I think of what is sort of the obvious concern, right? I mean, do you have different regulatory agencies competing for the business, and what does that mean in terms of prudential regulation of these institutions? And I hear you, and I've heard similar comments from people from other regulatory agencies of, it's not, cold calling at night and saying, come to us instead of the other guy. It's just, if you're interested, here's what the information is that you need to know to make your decision. But then we do also hear things like people saying they've heard secondhand that certain regulatory agencies may have been going further down the path or that increasing the outreach program. And we've also heard from folks that, before Director Rich, that the OTS was in somewhat of a shrinkage mode and, laying people off and morale was down, and that perhaps this was a way, the obvious thing that you think, that you don't want to believe, is that they're increasing revenue to hire more people and improve morale, and what does that imply or mean for the degree of rigorous prudential regulation? So, you know, obviously it's an area that as a commission, you know, we are looking at and want to understand, so I'd like to get, okay, you know, the viewpoint of you on what the risks are with,
sure,
that kind,
well,
of situation.
I don't like a system where, I mean, it's okay to have a system where there's choice, you know, state dual banking, you know, state charter, state license versus federal charter, federal license. You know, thrifts, you know, as a unique charter, fine. You know, to me, it should be a system where hopefully there's reasonable balance in, you know, what you have to pay for regulating. There's all, you know, in our minds, there's always been, you know, it gets played out all the time in the dual banking where states always market that they're cheaper, and their assessments many times are, than a federal bank assessment. You know, I don't think that's the way the system should be built, but the fact is that's the way it's run. You know, we like to think that, you know, if you're paying for a federal charter, you're getting the right kind of supervision in the sense of quality supervision, effective supervision. The preemption thing is certainly something that is a power that we think a federal, particularly a bank that's doing, you know, broad-based business, you know, it's a power and authority that attaches to a federal charter and is valuable for banks that want to do that. Doesn't mean every bank needs to have that, but banks that certainly operate in multi-states, you know, it certainly makes sense that authority you know, be known by institutions who are or are considering a federal charter. But well, we don't go out and kind of, you know, go down the list of state banks and try to pitch that each time. So bottom line is, I mean, for me, I don't think regulators should ever just be out, you know, competing with each other to gain business. You know, the state versus federal, that's more, you know, I don't know how you correct that unless you just, you know, create the common assessment process for every institution. And the FDIC versus OCC, you know, that's just kind of a non-event. I mean, every national bank has to be insured. If a bank chooses a state charter, so be it. You know, I always am concerned if they are running for a charter for not only lower cost, but less supervision. And in some cases, that's the way states operate. They're not equipped to provide much hands-on supervision. And some institutions like that. So, but it's their choice, in my mind, to do that, even if they leave from a national charter to whatever. Now, if there's problems, I think what the new legislation kind of embeds in the policy even before the new legislation of, you know, the agencies coming together that we're not going to let problem institution run and escape oversight by choosing a different charter. You know, I think that's a loophole that's existed that I think we've closed. But I don't like an environment where you just have regulators competing with each other for charters. So, if a bank makes a request and legitimately is interested in, you know, you want to do this business, we have an interest in this charter, can you help us with that? I think that's one thing. And if they go to three agencies to explore that, that's fine. But I don't like it when people are out distributing material and trying to solicit. I think that's, I'm not sure that's good for the system.
So let me ask you on the preemption issue. It reminded me of our first hearing way back in January where we had some state attorney generals in there that were candidly complaining,
yep,
about the preemption issue and their inability to go after federally chartered institutions for predatory lending type practices. Lisa Madigan from Illinois, I forget the gentleman's name, from Colorado, but, you know, asked them. Thank you. You know, so help me understand this. I mean, I get the point of preemption. But, like, I don't think the OCC ever took any action against Countrywide, for example, for predatory lending even though they have been sued since and have paid a lot of money to settle some of these suits. So, I mean, what was the OCC, since there was preemption, what was the OCC doing to then, you know?
I think that's really way beyond what we were prepared to talk about, and preemption was really covered ad nauseum with the comptroller.
Okay, has it been covered with him?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, there was a whole interview with him on preemption that...
That's fine.
And they touched on it in his testimony.
That's helped me for Friday, too.
No, that has been covered.
Well, that's fine.
Can I ask something that sticks out as far as the national, as far as the two regulatory system, or perhaps the bank holding company model that's being supervised by the Federal Reserve versus the savings and loan holding company? And this is in the public filings. They'll say that Countrywide Financial Corp is a bank holding company supervised by the Federal Reserve System,
right,
and we have to adhere to minimum Tier 1 leverage ratios that are mandated by the Federal Reserve at the bank holding company level. But then, prominently, on page 20 of the 2007 10-K, it says, as a savings and loan holding company, we do not have any minimum Tier 1 leverage requirements by our holding company supervisor. We only have to keep as much as they deem necessary, but there is no bright line. So to me, that's kind of like a clear play, one versus the other. Would you agree or
Okay. Yep.
And I guess I should have asked this earlier, and do you recall that being another reason that Countrywide switched?
No, okay.
I didn't know this until very recently, but I go, really? I couldn't believe that. And then you go to the OTS handbook for holding companies, and sure enough, that's what it says. So I learned something new.
Yeah, no, you always have to be careful between holding company and insured institution in terms of minimum capital. And they're not necessarily the same. But I did not know that. I mean, I knew that a unitary
holding company
didn't have that kind of the same minimum ratio requirements as an insured bank, but I never heard that in the course of their decision to convert.
After you guys are no longer regulating Countrywide and the OTS is, anybody at the OTS ever contact you, or did you ever hear that they contacted anybody at the OCC? Words to the effect like, boy, now that we're in here examining this shop after relying on your guys' and the Fed's reports, we're finding things are a lot worse than we thought they were?
I never had any conversation with anyone. Now, I don't know whether anyone else on my staff or in the agency did, but I know I did.
And just to close it out, understanding you didn't have any conversation, did you ever hear that the OTS was making those kinds of claims?
No.
Generally? Okay.
I just want to flag the closeout letter that did identify all the problems that we talked about with Kim.
The matters requiring attention.
Yeah.
Right. I think you flagged that in Kim's interview, too,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. It's your document number one.
Do you have anything else? Mr. Roeder, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.